Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We have to introduce friction into our life, and we live in technological times that tell us that introducing friction, you know, it's a bad thing to do. What you need is efficiency. And actually, you know, it's efficiency that's got us into this mess really.
Yes.
Well, we've all been pushed around.
Hello and welcome to It's Complicated, the podcast to help you untangle your relationship with your phone.
Left our hearts in the lost and found.
I'm Tanya Gooden, and each week I'll be talking to my guests about how they manage the relationship with the tiny tyrant in their pocket. We'll be talking about how our phone habits affect our work, our lives, and our loves, and about what our relationship with our phone might just tell us about our relationship with ourselves. If you want help and you want hope, you've come to the right place. This is It's Complicated. My guest this week definitely wins the prize for best name on the podcast so far. I'm talking to author and academic Professor Vibar Cragen-Reed. Vibar is reader in English and Environmental Humanities in the School of English at the University of Kent and has written widely on the subjects of literature, health, nature and the environment. His work has been featured in The Observer, The Sunday Times, The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Washington Post, the BBC, the Literary Review, and on many other print and digital platforms. His current book, Primate Change: How the World We Made is Remaking Us, looks at how our environment has changed our bodies, from our eyes and our teeth down to our toes. So timely that we're sitting here talking today, because a piece just came out yesterday which is trending everywhere online from the Washington Post. I'm just going to read the headline: Horns are growing on young people's skulls. Phone use is to blame, research suggests. I feel like I've read everything now about what mobile phone use is doing to us, but you are obviously the expert with your book, Primate Change. So I wanted to kind of bust some of the myths, because I realised when I read your book that I had been convinced some of the things I thought about what the, you know, tech world might be doing to us were true, and talk about what we do know the digital world is doing to us. So one of the quotes from your book is, "Our bodies are in shock. Modern living is as bracing to the human body as jumping through a hole in the ice." But what I didn't realise until I'd read your book was that some of those shocks to the system aren't as recent as we thought. And back pain, which I have entirely laid at the door of, you know, mobile phones and sitting down, is actually dates from Victorian times or before that?
Well, almost certainly before that. I think the ways in which our bodies function will mean that people have been struggling with back pain for probably 2 million years, ever since we got up onto 2 feet. However, I'm a literary historian by trade, or at least I was. And if you look for back pain in literature, it's not that easy to find. You know, there are certain complaints, like, so I'm an asthmatic. I'm not a chronic asthmatic, but I nearly am. But if you look for asthma in literary history, you'll find it, and you'll find it going all the way back to Homer. I mean, it's a bit tricky with Homer, you know, the Greek epic poet, because the word asthma actually means panting, and you're not sure
whether
he's talking about the disease,
yes,
asthma, or just, is he just a bit out of breath from swinging his sword around? So lots of pathologies do have a long history, and I'm sure back pain has a very long history, but you just don't find it in literary history. It's just not there. And now it's the number one cause of disability.
I was really shocked when I read that. I was just about to read that back to you. It's the single biggest cause of global disability. So is it made worse by our current habits, our sedentary habits, sitting down? Is that the cause, or is it far more complicated than that?
It's both simple and very complicated. So like many of the things that are not going well for humans just at the moment, it really is, it's a confluence of factors. Physiologically, most people have a deeply held belief that their pain is physiological, that it's about function, it's about them having a good posture, I must sit up straight, so as I don't get back pain. So there are certainly physiological drivers for back pain, things like degenerated discs or arthritis in the stacking joints of the spine. So you have a stacking joint on the side of each vertebra, so that when you bend backwards, the stacking joints, the apophyseal joints, lock together. And by the age of about 40, we have arthritis in at least one of these joints. 90% of people have arthritis in at least one of these joints.
Is that the Western world or everywhere? I mean, are there, people that, I'm thinking sub-Saharan Africa, areas where they're not seeing these problems?
There isn't funding to say that this is the case across the world. So it looks like this is the case across the Western world.
Yeah.
So these are all strong physiological drivers for causes of back pain. Arthritis from bending backwards, disc pain from bending forwards, having a ruptured disc. But there are also other factors that contribute to this weakness, this problem rather. One is the fact that we are just much, much weaker. We are much weaker than people were in the 19th century, than people were in the Metropolitan Revolution about 3,000-5,000 years ago, and during the Agricultural Revolution about 10,000 years ago. So between hunter-gatherers and us, there's no hard science for this, but if you draw together work that's been done by people at the University of Kent on hand strength, or work that was published at the beginning of 2017 on humeral rigidity, so the rigidity of the upper arm bones of different people. That work, for example, said that the bone density in women's arms from northern Eurasia from about 5,000 years ago showed greater strength and rigidity than Olympic rowers.
Wow.
So these were just everyday women.
And this is just because we're not doing physical labour anymore. Is
that, we don't
really
do anything anymore. Yeah. I mean,
so if we go to the gym and pump iron, that doesn't help.
It does help. Okay, right. So I say this in the book. I think I say it quite a few times. By far the worst thing always is to do nothing. So going to the gym for 30 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week, is not going to save you from all of the problems that are widely experienced in modern life, but it's definitely going to put you in better stead than someone that just stays at home and does nothing. So the fact that we're just much weaker means that we have less shielding to any pathology. And usually what any pathology will do is it will find the weakest point and it will expose itself there. Mm. And because our backs are, when we sit down, the lower part of our back is loaded with all the weight from our upper body. It looks like that's a peculiar center or nexus for pain. And then, of course, there's stress. So there's physiological causes of back pain. There's physiological causes that are connected to how we live. But then there's also emotional causes as well. Stress causes inflammation in the body. And inflammation is terrible. Inflammation, like I said, I'm an asthmatic. That's a chronic form of inflammation in the lungs that closes up the airways. Inflammation can give you heart attacks, can give you headaches, and it can definitely give you back pain. So inflammation plays a very, very big role in the experience of pain and pathology, and especially back pain.
One of the things that really surprised me when I was reading your section about the back was that no one actually knows what good posture is or what perfect posture is. And the reason why that was particularly significant for me is I went to one of those really traditional girls' schools where we were awarded a posture badge if we had good posture. And I never was awarded my posture badge. I left the school in disgrace because I, apparently didn't ever have good posture. So I was actually quite pleased when I read that there's no kind of objective test or rule that we can say that is absolutely what perfect posture, you know, the posture that might help our backs.
Yeah, there's no, you can't look at a diagram and say this is exactly how you should be. What we can do is we can speak in general terms, like the spine is supposed to be have a gentle S shape to it. We're not supposed to keep our backs completely straight. One of the things that we're both doing now is we're both sitting on chairs, but neither of us are using the back of the chair. We're both sitting, we're both using our bodies to support us.
Yeah.
And what that means is that, you know, epaxial and hypaxial muscles in our front and back are activated, holding ourselves upright.
So that's good doing that.
Yeah. So as soon as we sit back, I'm sitting back now. As soon as we sit back, what happens is those muscles just go,
Yeah.
You know, just like...
No work to do.
No work to do. And so they can rest. And muscles that are used, like at the gym, become stronger. Muscles that aren't used, they atrophy and they become weaker. So one of the many ways in which we are opening ourselves up to something like back pain is through certain kinds of chair use when we just relax.
So back pain, we can't lay at the door solely of our digital habits. It's much more complicated than that.
We pretty much can, really.
Oh, you think we can? Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, once you put all of this stuff together, the reason that we sit in chairs...
It's because we're looking at screens.
It's because we're looking at screens. It's, you know,
or before that, typewriters, I guess, and you know.
But you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, in the 1840s, about 0.02% of the population would be employed doing office work. And when they did do office work, you know, if you think about Kermit in the Muppet Christmas Carol, carrying around those big heavy
walking
ledgers,
walking around a lot.
So that they were still having to do some activity. I mean, they were much better off than most workers in the 19th century because they were indoors. But they were still having to do some work. And then once you cycle forwards a bit, I can't remember what the number is for the 1890s, but I think it's about 2 to 3% by the 1890s are in sedentary office work. Now it's about 85% of us.
Wow. And that's a big change in a relatively small period, isn't it, in our evolution?
It's a very, very, very big change. I mean, I think it's almost impossible to encompass how sudden these changes are. So if you think about a swimming pool, a 50-metre swimming pool, a big swimming pool, if humans begin at, you know, when you dive in, you swim along, and if that's a timeline, then the agricultural revolution comes at the end and it's about the width of a pound coin. And the industrial revolution...
We're in that little space that's a pound coin.
Yes, yeah, so all the changes to our teeth and the changes to our diet, changes to our height all happen in that amount of time. The Industrial Revolution is probably about a millimetre. I mean, this would be very easy to work out on a spreadsheet, but it's a tiny, tiny, tiny space of time that we're talking about. So in that time, about 10% of the human population exists in that time that's ever existed. So the population goes massively up. Mm. And then if you also think about the amount of sedentary work also goes up in that time as well. So we're doing a lot more sedentary work, and the sedentary work that we used to do involved some activity, but now because of computers, etc., it now means that we don't even do that anymore because filing, photocopying, faxing, all of that takes place behind a computer screen. So you can lay at the door of a digital life.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So eyesight. Eyesight's the next thing that I get asked about a lot.
You're short-sighted, I think.
I'm short-sighted. Yeah. We're both sitting here wearing glasses.
I've got presbyopia. I've got old man's long-sightedness.
And what I found really interesting when I read your book is that it's, and you're going to correct me if I've interpreted this wrong, but it's not necessarily reading or screens that's caused the problem. It's the fact that we're indoors more.
Yeah, so this is where science comes up against a real problem, because what they can't do is
take a control group.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
But what the outcomes of the research seem to be suggesting is that it's short-sightedness, myopia, is much more strongly connected not to close work but to experiencing good quality light that you get outside. So we're in my kitchen at the moment, and in here there's probably about 300 lumens, whereas outside there's probably about 1,000 or 1,500 lumens. So the human eye is very good at adapting to its environment, but as it's developing, so babies are all born long-sighted and their eye grows into a normal healthy eye. But to do this, it needs the right cues, so that a child's eye needs to know when it's reached that optimum shape, and it can't do that without good quality light.
That's fascinating. I mean, I get asked a lot about this screen and eyesight issue. And one of the other episodes of the podcast that I did in the first series was about spending time outside and how the current generation of children are spending about, you know, almost a tenth of the amount of time outside that their parents did.
Less time outside than prison inmates.
Wow. So all the things I read in the press saying, look at all the children with glasses, it's because of screens. It actually probably isn't the screen. It's the fact that, well, I mean, the screen might be contributing to the fact that they're spending more time indoors, but
screen use is almost always takes place indoors.
Yeah. So some of the other things that might be more strongly linked, we've talked a little bit about the very sedentary lifestyle, and you were saying, because I've talked about this before, our obsession with our 10,000 steps, everybody with their Fitbits and with their iPhone trackers. And I think you said, actually, I'm going to quote you here, when history looks back at the weird life we all lead in offices, it will see that these are an environment as toxic as those in the 19th century factories.
Yeah.
So we're just not spending enough time moving around. Is it just our working life, the fact that we're in offices and we're sitting at screens, or is it, you know, just generally we're not moving enough?
We don't move enough. So we spend a lot of our time working. We spend about, you know, 40 hours of our week working. Some people more, some people a little less, perhaps. So what used to be 0.02% of a workforce, you know, being sedentary at work, now it's 85%. So it's now normal to do nothing all day. But then, like modes of entertainment are almost always sedentary. Mm. I've just spent the last two evenings watching a fantastic Netflix series. But we were finishing it last night and I just thought, God, this required me to sit on the couch for 8 hours over 2 days.
Yeah.
So it's that modes of entertainment are now sedentary as well. And once you put these two things together, it then becomes no surprise that, you know, seven of the top 10 killers from the World Health Organization are associated with the great activity drop. Technology has a sort of places as kind of inheritance tax on us. So it's hard for us to think back more than a couple of generations. And what happens is technology, when it's invented, has to solve a particular problem. It has to make something easier for us. You know, no one's going
to... for it to be adopted.
Yeah, no one's going to buy a washing machine that makes it harder to wash your clothes. And then what happens is technology incrementally changes. We inherit habits from the previous generation And we think the previous generation's habits were normal. And then we think, oh, well, that saved us this little bit of work. But once you take a slightly longer view, the changes become much more drastic. So to clean a rug in the 1930s or 1940s, you'd move the furniture back. You would roll up the rug, you'd sling the rug over your shoulder, you'd take it into your backyard.
Oh, you put it over the line and beat it, wouldn't you?
And then you'd beat it.
Yeah.
It's always fascinating. You know, the few occasions I've done it, you just think, oh my God,
such
what is
hard
all that
work.
Stuff?
I've done it once.
And then you reverse the process, you roll it back up, take it back, put it back on the floor and put all the furniture back. So that's probably a calorie burn of about 200 to 300 calories. Now, the next technological step is for me to pick up my phone, press about 5 buttons, and then, you know, Mr. Robovac will then go to work around the room and do all the work for me. So we used to do the rug beating, then we did the U-Bank. Do you remember that useless?
Yes.
Oh, God. U-Bank vacuum cleaner, which still, you know, it still required...
You still had to push it, and they were quite heavy, the old ones.
The old
ones remember.
Were, yeah.
I remember trying to help my mother Hoover, and, you know, they were a lot of effort.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, now I've got one of these little hand vac things. It's much, much lighter.
Yeah.
And it saves you the trouble of having to plug it in, etc. So we go through several changes, and what started off as 200 to 300 calories becomes 0.2 or 0.3 calories. So that's a movement drop of 1,000%. And it seems to us completely normal. Nobody buys a RoboVac thinking, right, this has saved me 300 calories. So what am I going to do to put
instead,
that movement back?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is like an inheritance tax that's happening in all parts of our lives to the point where it's very, very difficult to find movement. Who washes... I mean, I do wash some of my clothes by hand, but who washes their clothes by hand?
I remember my grandmother telling me that she had a day set aside. I think it was a Wednesday that was her wash day, and it took all day because everything was done by hand.
Who's got a day, Tanya?
Yeah.
Who's got a day?
But I mean, she, you know, she was a very fit woman until, yeah. You know, and a very long, you know, she lived a very long life. So she was obviously keeping healthy doing all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So for longevity, for example, it looks like, you know, doing a high intensity interval session at the gym, while better than nothing, it looks like much of the longevity benefits that we can garner, that we can make for ourselves, that aren't just inherited through our genes, are through elongating low levels of activity throughout our day.
So we can't exercise our way out of a sedentary lifestyle by spending all day sitting down, going to the gym for an hour, and then going home and spending all day sitting down. Is that essentially what you're saying?
It's definitely better to do that.
Yeah, than nothing. Yeah.
But if it's longevity that you're interested in, you'd be much better off spending 4, 5, 6 hours of your day doing, you know, very light or moderate activity than you would doing a 7-minute workout. That's incredibly intense.
Is that as simple as just walking everywhere? I mean, you know, not walking, getting off the tube 3 stops before you need to, or the bus, or, you know, trying to build that in.
Yeah, the thing is...
And walking around the office? Should we be moving around? In fact, there was something in your book, I think, where you said to be really healthy, we needed to get up and walk around and stretch every 2 to 3 minutes. And, you know, that just wouldn't work, would it?
No, it wouldn't work. We have to introduce friction into our life, and we live in technological times that tell us that introducing friction, you know, it's a bad thing to do. What you need is efficiency. And actually, you know, it's efficiency that's got us into this mess really.
Yes.
So you do, you have to introduce friction, and the problem with introducing friction is it is frictional. It takes a lot of time. So for me, when I got to the end of the book, I got rid of my car.
Wow.
I live in London, so it's not such a terrible thing
to do. And
that
was a conscious decision as a result of all the research you did for the book.
Yeah. It's not as fantastic as it sounds. I do occasionally borrow a friend's car. But yeah, it was a decision from doing the book. So I also got loads of houseplants, as you can see.
I can, yeah. It's lovely.
Houseplants, got rid of the car. And I also just walk loads more. So I try, like lots of people, I have activity trackers.
Yeah.
And I try to be active between 1.5 to 2 hours a day. And that's hard. That's hard.
And then, but yeah, if we kind of imagined our parents and grandparents, grandparents would definitely have been active for more
easily,
than that, wouldn't
yeah.
they?
So yeah. I made some programs for the BBC. We made a series called Changing World, Changing Bodies. And for one of the programs, we went to the Rift Valley in Kenya, to a village called Pemjo, which it's not accessible by car. It's not like an English village where everything's bunched together, you know, like huddled together in the cold. It's really, really spread out. But we spoke to people there actually about back pain.
And do they have back pain?
No. Not really, no.
They didn't know what you were talking about.
we did meet one person.
Right.
But she carried sort of heavy loads on her back and on her head for about 5 hours a day. So that you thought, okay. And the body's very much, we all have Goldilocks bodies where it doesn't like too little and it doesn't like too much. It likes loading to be just right. But we met a guy there called Mike, and I chatted to him about his activity levels. And he said that he does about 5 to 6 hours work, light manual work a day. And then after that, he would do a leisure walk where he'd be out for 3 to 4 hours. Now, he wouldn't be sort of strolling in the mountains. What he'd be doing would be, because the village is spread out, he'd be probably be walking around the village and stopping and chatting to people.
Sorry, what you can't see is my jaw dropping open at the thought of a leisure walk being 3 to 4 hours. Yeah.
So it meant he was active for about 10 hours a day.
That's phenomenal, isn't
it? And
there
was a bit, yeah, and there's a moment in the episode where my jaw dropped as well, and I was saying, gosh, I think I'm really good, and I do 90 minutes. Yeah.
So hands.
Yeah.
I want to talk about hands, because again, this was another really fascinating bit of the book. When you were posing the question, will our hands no longer be necessary in the future? Which actually is a really good question when you think about how many voice-operated assistants we're developing and driverless cars and we think we're using our hands a lot, don't we, with all our texting and tapping and swiping.
We are.
Actually, compared to what our hands are designed for, that's not enough.
No, I mean, I spoke to an expert called Professor Tracy Kivel on the evolution of hands, and we talked about RSIs. In fact, I don't think I quoted it in the book, but she just said that the kind of repetitive work that we worry about, you know, about developing RSIs, she said that actually humans have always done that. You know, napping stone tools is a stressful thing for those joints to have to.
And there's 19th century seamstresses that you talked about in the book. You know, that's very repetitive, sitting and
making
sewing.
Matchboxes.
Yes,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So lots of industrial work would have been incredibly.
So
repetitive.
We probably had RSI before. We didn't call it RSI, and it wasn't connected with a screen. It's just any kind of repetitive hand gesture.
Yeah, but I think one of the main differences now would be a little bit like back pain. So if there's a Venn diagram of back pain where you have physiological causes, psychological causes, or emotional causes, in that Venn diagram is also, you know, fitness and strength of the given structures. Our hands must be super weak. I mean, they don't do anything. They don't do anything. They don't, unless they go to the gym, they don't lift any heavy weights. We don't do manual work. You know, swipe. Oh, you just heard my thumb click. You don't do, you know, swiping Instagram isn't a great workout for your thumb.
No.
So our hands, because of the kind of work we do, are probably just much, much weaker, so that they're more likely to develop problems because they're just more physiologically available to pathologies arising because of their weakness.
And I know I've come across people talking about the issue with handwriting and children, that actually because, and do you know what, I found this myself, that if you use a screen a lot, when you suddenly have to write, it actually hurts. I was writing a whole load of thank you letters.
It hurts and you're rubbish at it.
Yeah,
as well.
I was writing thank you letters over Christmas and I thought, these are illegible. And, you know, after only writing about three, my hand was hurting. But teachers are saying they're seeing that increasingly more in schools, that children just can't write. Because there is quite, you know, a little bit of strength that's involved in holding a pen, isn't there, in the right way?
There's strength and there's also precision. And it's, you know, it's, as we all remember learning to write, it's you know, it's a practiced precision skill. I've got an app for my iPad. So instead of typing notes on my iPad now, I make handwritten notes. And the reason I've done it is it's a bit less convenient. It's still quite convenient, but it's handwriting recognition. And if I don't write neatly, it won't recognise it. So it's just trying to get me back into the habit of writing legibly.
So I can see what we could do. I mean, not entirely, but I could see a little bit about what we could do for backs and eyesight.
Mm.
But with hands, what could we do that would actually help strengthen? I mean, is it as simple as just getting those squeeze balls.
Yes.
We're both doing the hand movements as we're saying this. You know, this, you can get those things that are supposed to strengthen your hands that you kind of squeeze.
So yeah. I'm right-handed, but I use my mouse with my left hand. And it's one of those things that you don't really acknowledge yourself. And then when people see you doing it, they go, but you're right-handed. And the reason it happened was because I had RSI when I was doing my PhD in about the year 2000. I was working on a PhD all day and then gaming in the evening. And I was stressed as well. My right wrist was just like, no, that's enough.
So instead of giving up all the gaming,
yes,
you thought,
I just learned to
I'll
use it with
my left hand. I'm not sure that's sending the right message.
No, it's not, but I think...
So are you ambidextrous?
No, I'm not. No. I'm not, but just mouse. So I can use a mouse with it really accurately. Well, so accurately that that's just what I do. But what I did was I deliberately tried to develop strength in both my hands. And I did that. I wouldn't recommend this for other people, but I did it by squeezing tennis balls.
Because they're hard to squeeze.
And then
yeah.
doing press-ups on my fingers.
Oh.
Which I would not recommend. No.
There's a yoga pose, actually, that involves doing that, and it's very... I've tried that a few times. It's very painful.
Yeah, so I'm 50 now. I don't think I'd risk it.
Interesting that you just outed yourself a little bit about your screen habits there, because I just want to talk to you now about your screen habits.
Yeah.
And there's three questions I've been asking everyone on the podcast.
Oh, dear.
If you had one message to give to everyone about their screen and phone habits, you know, maybe related to what we've been talking about, the physical impacts, or maybe not, what would you like people to think about?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure if it's a message for other people or if it's a message that I would want to just, you know... have written down for myself, really, which is that we think our phones are the modes of connection with other people, but they're not really. The way to connect with other people is to go outside
And meet them in the real world.
And meet them, and or even, you know, go for a walk and be in a natural environments and not be listening to music and the news, which is really, really stressful. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have very good screen health. But it is something that I'm aware of.
So you've made a lot of conscious decisions as a result of writing the last book about your kind of health.
Yeah.
So have you got any tips that you want to share that you've... I mean, have you changed your phone or screen habits as a result of that? Was some of that to do with tech use?
Actually, I thought my screen habits were okay. And I would say that publishing a book is probably part of... a recipe for making your screen habits worse.
Yes. I know, I've been there. Yes.
So I'd say that my screen habits have got slightly worse since the book came out. And it is something... So I've deleted Twitter from my phone. I did that about 4 or 5 days ago. Because I just thought, I used to read a book, you know, in a day. If I wanted to sit down and read a book, I'd read a book in a day. And I started rereading Jane Austen's Persuasion about 5 days ago. It's 180 pages, and I think I'm on page 40, which is tragic, I think.
That's actually one of the reasons I started out on this whole exercise, is I realised I stopped reading.
Yeah, so. I have stopped reading. I've definitely stopped reading. I conduct ram raids on books now rather than...
And what have you learned about yourself in all the years that you've been using screens? So you were talking about being a gamer?
Yeah.
A few years ago and learning how to use both hands. Do you think your use of screens has changed over time?
So I would never sort of identify as a gamer. I definitely do play games, but I think whenever I hear the word gamer, I think it's someone who could spend all day doing it.
Yeah, sitting in a darkened room.
Yeah. So I wouldn't really call myself a gamer because I usually play, I'll play a game for about 30, maybe 60 minutes. And then I just think, right, it's time to do something else now. As a result of writing the book, I'm constantly aware of my activity levels on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And I'd say one of the other things that I now do is I often go out for an evening walk, which is a bit weird when you don't even have a dog. But
get a dog. That's the answer, isn't it?
Yeah. So I don't think my screen habits have changed all that much, but the activity that happens in between has definitely changed a lot.
Yeah. I want to thank you.
Thank
so
you very much.
Much for chatting to me.
Oh, my watch has just binged me to stand up.
Go on then, stand up while I do this. To follow Vibar on Twitter, just remember he's not on it all the time, is you're just Vibar on Twitter.
VYBARR.
Yeah, and on Instagram, you're VibarCR.
That's correct.
And I would definitely recommend to anyone listening to go out and get Primate Change, How the World We Made is Remaking Us. at Amazon and at all good bookshops.
Thank you very much. It was a fascinating read.
Really recommend it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of It's Complicated. If you haven't already, please do subscribe, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps other people find us and it means you get a helpful little notification when a new episode becomes available. For more about getting a healthy balance with tech, you can follow me, Tanya Goodin, or Time to Log Off on Instagram and Twitter. And both my books, Off and Stop Staring at Screens, are available on Amazon and at all good bookshops. Finally, for more information about this and other episodes in the podcast series, visit itstimetologoff.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.